Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truth.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we program weird and wonderful science directly into your circuits. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this edition, David Hinwood designs robots to combat fabric waste. But first up, here's news of anti-aging fruit and smaller smart dust. Petenga prolongs. The Brazilian petenga fruit, Eugenia uniflora, has been fed to biologists' favourite nematode worm, Cynorhabditis elegans, with the result that the genes controlling lifespan were expressed in a way that should extend their life by preventing cancer and the diseases of old age. The ageing of humans is affected by the same DAF16-FOXO gene expression pathways as the worms. The paper doesn't say how much the lifespans of the worms are extended. The fruits are cherry-sized and look like little Chinese lanterns. They vary from red to very dark, almost black purple. Previous studies have shown that the leaves of the petenga fruit tree have anti-inflammatory, anti-diabetic, anti-malarial, and anti-leishmania properties. The researchers from the Federal University of Pampa and the University of Campinas in Brazil fed an extract of the fruit to the nematode worms and performed various stressing experiments that mimic aging. Oxidative stress has been proposed as one of the main causes of aging and has been implicated in the development of many diseases. Oxidative stress is when there's an imbalance between free radical molecules that have free electrons that can quickly cause harmful chemical reactions and antioxidants that protect cells by binding with the free radicals before they can cause damage. The researchers caused oxidative stress to the worms by exposing them to hydrogen peroxide and jugolone, the brown dye in henna. The worms were harmed less by the oxidative stress and more easily able to heal from oxidative stress when they'd been eating the petenga fruit extract. They found no toxic effects at all. The researchers were able to observe that the worms express more of the DAF16-FOXO genes that have been found to slow down aging. They're able to detect increased levels of the enzyme superoxide dismutase and the heat shock protein HSP16.2, caused by activity in the DAF16 genes working to regulate aging and fight against oxidation. When they gave the same petenga fruit extract to knockout worms that had the DAF16 genes removed with CRISPR, the worms didn't increase their levels of superoxide dismutase and heat shock protein HSP16.2. This strongly suggests that the benefits of the fruit are from its action on these DAF16 genes. The researchers speculate that the chemical that makes the fruit purple, cyanidin-12-3-0-glycoside, is the source of most of the benefits because it's a strong antioxidant. But they will be conducting more research to find out for certain. In the meantime, they encourage people to eat more petenga fruit. I'm still waiting for my little potted petenga tree to flower so I can try the fruit. The paper was titled Purple Petenga Fruit, Eugenia uniflora L, protects against oxidative stress and increases the lifespan of Cynorhabditis elegans via the DAF16-FOXO pathway, and was published in the journal Food and Chemical Toxicology. Smart dust has shrunk. Back in January 2007, I reported on tiny robots the size of fleas that were fitted with sensors and networking components so they could share data and computing resources. And they'd been given legs so they could walk and even jump around like fleas. The joke was that they were more like smart gravel than the smart dust they were trying to be because they had to be big enough to contain a battery. 12 years later, these robots have now been shrunk to the size of actual dust. They're closer to smart dust. Smart dust is the ultimate evil genius tool. Smart dust has sensors for light, heat, sound, and chemicals. It communicates by radio with other specks of smart dust to form a distributed computer network. Smart dust can be used to track people in natural disasters, to gather environmental data such as sniffing out pollution in difficult or distant environments, inside the body, and for all manner of scientific and surveillance purposes. Naturally, the micro-electromechanical systems of smart dust are solar-powered. Clouds of smart dust could be genuine cloud computers. The latest smart dust is made of silicon, which lets researchers leverage all the years of work on silicon chip manufacture. We already know how to build all kinds of sensors and radio transceivers right into silicon. The Cornell University researchers put layers of platinum and titanium on a tiny silicon wafer which will flex when a current is applied. This tiny motor can move the legs of the robots, which are only 100 atoms thick. Instead of batteries, the tiny robots have solar panels on their backs that are powered in the lab by shining laser light on them. These robots run on a fraction of a volt and consume only 10 billionths of a watt of power. They can make 1 million micro robots from just 10 centimeters or 4 inches of silicon wafer. The robots' bodies are built on a super thin rectangular skeleton of glass, topped with a thin layer of silicon onto which researchers etch the electronics control components and a few silicon solar cells. The robots are tiny enough to be injected into the body in a hypodermic needle, but they can't swim yet. And they need a source of power that isn't light. Magnetic fields or ultrasound waves might be the solution for powering the robots inside the body. Robots that can swim could travel through your bloodstream, healing injuries, killing cancer, or mapping the connections in your brain. The research was presented at a meeting of the American Physical Society in Boston in March 2019, with the title, Fabricating Autonomous Machines for the Cellular Scale.
Time when man began to control environment, he has been plagued by his limited ability to speculate. His failure to accurately predict the effect in the contraposed action. This is the result of his not being able to consider and relate all the factors in a problem. Evidence of this inability can be seen in the persistence of a certain kind of myth involving three wishes. In a frantic effort to reap immediate reward, the first wish is often not too wise. The second usually tends to overcorrect. Our hero can consider himself lucky if after the last wish, he ends up just where he started. But there were men whose wishes were not only prudent, but had a habit of coming true. These men and women were artists.
You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Could we recycle fabric? David Hinwood is a PhD student at the University of Canberra, who's designing robots to recycle the textiles in old clothes. I spoke to David by Skype and began by asking him, how did he get interested in robots?
It started probably about 2.5 years ago. So I worked in software development for a year before coming back to pursue robotics. So it started with me just doing some very basic computer vision algorithms for robots playing soccer. I don't know if you know the RoboCup, where little humanoid robots play soccer.
The little Ibo?
Yeah, the little Neos, yeah. So I think by 2050, they want to have a full robotic soccer team play against a human soccer team and see if they can win. So that kind of sparked my interest initially. Professor here, Roland Goecki, was leading the endeavor. So I did honors in that for a year. And then after that, after I finished honors, I kind of thought about what I wanted to do. And the primary goal was I very much wanted to start a business around robotics, but I didn't really know where to start or what to look for. So very recently, the University of Canberra hired a second professor, Dr. Damith Rath, who's pretty well known in human-robot interaction and has some experience in business and robotics and trying to get that working. So I had a conversation with him, and he kind of said, well, look, the key thing to remember is robotics are nowhere near a level where they can dynamically be integrated into the workforce. So they're very good at simple repetitive tasks, but when it comes to things that are more dynamic, so the primary example being manipulating fabric, which can kind of appear in a nearly infinite amount of states, whether they're spread out, crumpled together, and it doesn't really revert to any initial position. So he said, well, that's kind of where your best bet will be, is find a niche where that will work. So for about 6 months, I worked with him in HRI, which is human-robot interaction. So measuring a human's response to robots and seeing whether that robots could be perceived as friendly or threatening, and whether things like robotic arms could appear like they have a personality. So I studied that for about 6 months, and at the same time kind of formulated or looked for some problems and some robotic solutions, which I would enjoy working on. So throughout that time, we actually, do you know the Questacon Museum in Canberra?
Oh, yes.
We deployed two exhibits there measuring human-robot interaction. So the first one was a Baxter robot, which was developed by Rethink Robotics. And we actually got it to play tic-tac-toe with adults and children and do things like cheating and playing the game and expressing their disappointment or happiness that it won in different ways. So, you know, whether people kind of saw the robot as arrogant for winning or whether they saw it as a sore loser, whether they saw it as a cheater, stuff like that. So then we deployed a second project where a robot actually drew artwork with people, and people kind of drew with the robot and saw how it interpreted and added to the drawing. So those two experiments were fairly successful. We got some academic works published and presented at a few conferences, which was good fun. So at about the same time, I started looking into the textile waste problem. I actually have a relative who works for the Ethical Forum Fashion in London. And she kind of very much thought the concept or understood the problem of textile waste and kind of said, yeah, no, automation is actually very good, which would be very beneficial in combating this issue. So that's where the interest kind of started. So I started my literature review and started looking at a wide array of topics. So I looked at how computers visually interpret clothing, because we as people, we kind of instinctively kind of know, you know, where to grasp the corner of a shirt or the sleeve. We know how to identify these parts. And we also kind of instinctively, through years of learning and years of living, we can kind of say, oh, that's a button there. I can just grab some scissors and take this button off. So a lot of work in robotics has mainly focused on domestic chores. So for example, having a robot that can fold your laundry obviously appeals to a lot of people, but very few works were kind of focusing on combating textile waste. So the two key things I wanted to keep in mind were building robots that were relatively cheap and able to basically place in an environment and start picking up, evaluating and sorting clothing. And the second thing it has to be able to do is understand what composition is. So there's a lot of very talented researchers and new business endeavors that are actually focused on chemically recycling clothing, so you can separate the synthetic blends from the natural blends. So one of the key pipelines there is the labor force. It's to make these businesses profitable. A sustainable model isn't hiring people to do it. You know, even at minimum wage, it doesn't really pan out in producing new materials from our textile waste. It doesn't work economically. So by looking at the basic tasks that are required in these chemical processes, I kind of found, or what areas I should investigate in terms of automation. So the most basic task is just simple sorting. So being able to pick up a piece of clothing, whatever it is, identify what composition, so whether it's a polyester cotton blend, and then sort into that pile. And the second key thing is being able to eliminate things like buttons and zippers on the clothing, as that isn't exactly great for the chemical processes. They need to kind of separate the foreign objects just to optimize the process and reduce the amount of filtering it needs to do. So focusing on those kind of two key areas. So the first kind of part of my PhD is focusing on how we can just simply pick up clothing. So current robotic grippers are quite static in nature. There's a lot of work being done in soft robotics, but I'm hoping to build a robot hand specifically designed to grasp fabric. So a couple of key areas are, how do we grasp clothing on a linear surface, for example, which is quite difficult for quite static robotic grippers? And what inspirations can we take from our own hands, our own biomimetic features that can be integrated in the robot hand? So one project that's kind of fascinating is looking at the fingernail of the human hand. So we actually adjust the amount of friction we apply on an object when we use our fingernail in a variety of tasks. So a primary example is if you just run your soft fingertip across a table, it's quite smooth. When you run your fingernail across, it's also relatively smooth. But when you actually put both your fingertip and your fingernail on a surface, you significantly increase the friction factor. So you can easily pick up cloth. Basically looking at features like that, and then of course compliant joints in the human hand. So when you lay fingertips to put a table, which kind of joints really comply to the surface? My current thought process on that is basically really the joints that connect our palm to our fingers are actually the main ones that adapt to the surface. So those are kind of the first few areas I'm investigating, and how can we put these on robotic grippers. And obviously there's a lot more work to do on top of that, but just focusing on those two simple things kind of enables me to move forward and get a prototype going, so we can actually start picking up some momentum and doing the much more advanced things like computer vision, applying tools that can cut the buttons and zippers, computer vision algorithms that can actually, whether we want to focus on people who are shredding textiles, we want to focus on proper garments. So focusing on this area first and then hoping to branch out very soon.
That's amazing. So there'd be a whole new industry, because at the moment, as you say, it's just not profitable to do, but it would be if you could do this properly. When you sort the different textiles, they can be recycled in different ways.
Yeah, there are some limitations. So, for example, there's a very interesting company called BlockTex. I briefly chatted to one of the staff over there, and this is kind of a second hand, at least of what I've seen in the news and stuff. But from my understanding, they can only do polyester and cotton right now, but they can actually separate the synthetic and the natural fibers just using that. So that already is a huge kind of chunk of our clothing taken care of. And obviously, if I can integrate these devices that can actually identify the fabric composition, then we can build an automated pipeline that can just basically take a big pile of unorganized clothing and hopefully at a point move them to a point where they're just ready to be dumped in the chemical processes.
And what sort of sensor can tell the difference between the types of fabric?
This is where I need to do some thinking. So there's a lot of research being done to identify clothing composition simply by feel. However, it's not 100% accurate. And we already have industrial devices. So I think it's spectroscopy. So near-infrared sensors are actually, they're at a stage already where they can pretty much fully identify the composition. So integrating a NIR sensor into the actual hand itself is probably the way to go. But there's a lot more to it than just saying, oh, this is just this composition. You also need to be able to apply a sense of touch to the robot hand. And there are various sensors that do this. Figuring out the optimal one is obviously part of my PhD. Basically, the ability to kind of, you know, if we close our eyes and pick up a piece of clothing, what kind of motions do we use between our fingers to kind of say, oh, we're holding one layer, we're holding multiple layers, we're holding something very light, we're holding something a bit heavy? Because robots in general aren't good at that instinctive, just immediate being able to tell what they're holding. And generally they require a couple of different data streams from various sensors to infer the most information possible. So it's kind of a combination, I guess, of making sure I don't reinvent the wheel. So technology that already exists, I'd rather just use and focus on the things that are novel. Being able to find that balance and build a product based around that is the is the goal.
And I guess the robot hands have to be pretty delicate not to rip the fabric.
Yeah, it's quite hard to rip fabric, especially with the design I'm going for, because I'm very much focused on just kind of human-based robot hands. So, especially with one hand, which, and two, it is, at least I haven't managed to without significant effort, be able to tear apart clothing. And especially as well, you need to tear it by an edge to kind of do that. So I'm hoping these grippers don't exert enough force to be able to do that. That's not the goal. If it's textile waste as well, it doesn't really matter. But a really difficult part, because that's just obviously just grasping and just sorting. The really difficult part is going to build something dexterous enough that's able to actually remove the buttons or zippers from the clothing. So whether we use some kind of saw or whether we use some kind of like scissor-like effector is, I think that's going to be the main pipeline or the main difficulty.
And so how much of this is hands-on in the lab and how much of this is you planning it all ahead?
I'm hoping, like, so I've been a PhD, you've got your lit review stage, which is a lot of lying on a couch and reading papers, but I'm very much hoping I'm towards the end of that progress. And obviously I have to keep reading as you go through. But I've bought a variety of sensors to test and see which ones result in more optimal grasping. And we've got kind of all the kit and stuff ready to go. So it'll just be a matter of building and then starting to run experiments and building the actual product. So probably over the next year, right, well, the optimal goal is to have one in 3 months, but obviously plans get sidetracked, things go. So might not meet that deadline, but hopefully we do and can start some momentum there and try and build some devices that can actually do the initial sorting task.
And you've been involved in presenting your ideas in a couple of different places. I believe you've pitched it to entrepreneurs and you've done FameLab.
Yeah, still, I still need some practice at pitching, but presented it, yeah, to quite a few people, talking to businesses. But with robotics, there's a lot of doubt around it and very justified doubt because there's obviously been a number of robotic endeavors. We have, you know, gotten some momentum, built some prototypes, but then they've reached kind of a peak at which people lose interest. I'm very much hoping to start a series of basic steps and just move my way forward independently. So once we can, which is a big part of where human-robot interaction comes into it. So if you can kind of get humans working on one side of it, even if it's not profitable, and then just at the very least doing the steps the robots can't do, and then get the robots to do the next steps, and then slowly but surely build our way into automating the entire process. Hopefully this, I'm very much wary of the perception around robots and stealing jobs. So, but truthfully, this just isn't an industry right now. So, at least in my opinion, best case scenario, we create a few new jobs and over time slowly automate them. If they're jobs that don't exist now, even creating some ones short term and then slowly removing them, I don't think people complain too much. So.
Well, surely there's got to be some interest in the fact that you're making possible recycling that isn't happening at the moment because it's not profitable.
Yeah, it's a very easy idea to sell, which I guess is quite lucky, but kind of pitching an idea is only getting so far. At the end of the day, you really need something physical and something working to kind of prove that this is possible. Because at this stage, obviously, we don't even know if it is. It's just a concept. The work of my PhD has indicated that it is possible. At least I'm hoping it's possible. But the key step from here is getting some prototypes and demos up and running.
I think so. I think once you can show your robot doing its thing, people will be very excited.
Yeah. It's in the previous work we've done, yeah, that's kind of the way it's gone. Hopefully, utilizing robotics, we can start endeavors which previously were not possible while creating a better future for our planet.
Well, David, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you for talking to me.
That was David Himwood, PhD student at the University of Canberra, talking about designing robots to recycle used textiles. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Do you have a science outreach grant that you should tell me about? Send your contribution, opinions, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolf. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, 2XXFM in Canberra, and my local station 2RDJ in Burwood, New South Wales. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com. Check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 950 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Support the show at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolf. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolf. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.